Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen. Coming up in our first segment are two reports from CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news reporter Chris Laurie on the Kingston School of Art and the recent renaming of Leon Center to Slush Puppy Place in Kingston. Over to Chris.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. The Kingston School of Arts celebrates another successful year and is looking forward to another year of community arts programming. This month, KSOA has welcomed a new executive director, Victoria Smythe. Smythe has been involved with the school before in a volunteer capacity, including this year's juried exhibition in the fall. To chat about her start with KSOA and in the spirit of heading into a new year, I sat down with Smythe and we got into wrapping up 2023 and heading into 2024 with KSOA.
To get us started, I was wondering if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Victoria Smythe. I'm the new executive director at the Kingston School of Art.
Awesome. Good stuff. And how long have you been with KSOA?
So this is actually only my third week. So I'm still incredibly new. I'm still very much using the I'm new here. And working my way in.
That's really exciting. How's it been like coming in with this like fresh lens for the last few weeks?
It's been pretty good. I was a volunteer here for the juried exhibition that just happened. So I already had a bit of a relationship with the school. But not working on a full-time basis. I've always been really excited by what the school has done and what, how we're a part of the community. All the things that my predecessor Maddie accomplished in the last year have been fantastic. And I've just been really excited to be able to continue on with that.
And how has your first month been?
Exhausting.
Yeah, I imagine.
It's a lot of information. We have tons of programs every term. So wrapping my brain around that has been a lot. I got really lucky because I came in right when the fall term was really ending, and Maddie was really great at making sure that the winter term was all basically wrapped up and ready for me. It was my Christmas present. And so I've been able to come in at a really quiet time of the year and be able to actually have time to wrap my head around everything and go into the winter term all ready to go.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what has surprised you as you came into the school?
You know, the Kingston School of Art, this 2024 is actually going to be our 30-year anniversary of being open. And probably the thing that surprised me the most was the fact that up until about 3 years ago when Moira DeMorris took over as the executive director, before then the school had been run entirely by volunteers. And obviously they were very successful at running the school. But for anyone who doesn't work outside of nonprofits, having an organization run entirely by volunteers is actually a really big feat to accomplish. Because volunteers are wonderful and everything. But sometimes just the organization of it can be really difficult. And so having the school be so successful for all that time strictly run by volunteers is just, it was very surprising for me.
Yeah, that's an amazing accomplishment. So you'd say that's one of the biggest challenges, I guess, KSOA has, I wouldn't say overcome, I'd say took head on, you know, in the last few years.
Yeah, like I think probably just shifting from being entirely volunteer run to bringing in actual staff has definitely been a change. And you know, put a focus on being like, okay, well, what were maybe some of the things that fell through cracks, or, you know, where are our policies, or, you know, just kind of shifting the focus and making sure that everything was just, you know, being run the way that a nonprofit has to be. I don't know if I'm wording that properly or not, but, you know, just it is very different when it's actual staff running it versus volunteers.
I was going to ask, I mean, you've only been with the school for a short time in this capacity, but I was wondering if you have any memories from 2023 that you'd like to share as some of your favorites.
When you asked me to do this interview, I reached out to the board just because I am very new here and I've only had a viewpoint as an outsider from here. And they gave me a couple highlights, which I very much agree with because they are very big projects. And one of the really cool ones that happened was at the beginning of the year, we started 2023 with a bang, and we had our Indigenous Canoe Garden project. QBACC worked with us and artists Jaylene Cardinal and Dakota Ward to create an Indigenous canoe garden at Queen's University. But the artists actually used our window art gallery as a studio space to paint canoes. And the public was invited to come in certain days of the week and be able to actually watch them paint the canoes, kind of as an artist in residency throughout January. And having the open studio visits and a series of workshops, and they were able to really connect with the community that way. And then the canoes were installed at Queen's University in May. So that was a really great start for a year. We also had our Arts and Edu Action project, which was a collaboration between us and the Limestone School Board. And we also had funding from the Community Foundation, where we had teaching artists go into schools and work with teachers on how to bring arts more into the classroom and how to teach the arts that way. And the teachers actually came to the school as well to learn how to do it. And they kind of went back and forth with a bit of a mentorship project and a peer-to-peer mentorship. And probably the other thing that I was a really big fan of was the pride quilt that we had. So we had about 1,000 squares that were prepared and distributed. Teachers could apply for art kits to be able to participate. And so we sent out all these squares to the teachers that applied for them. And when they got returned to KSOA, all the students had decorated them and we were able to sew 5 panels of quilts together to create 5 large pride quilts. It was a really cool sight. These quilts were included in the pride parade and they've been showcased at a bunch of different community organizations like Trellis and the Faculty of Education, the TET Center here. And yeah, it was really cool to see just so many schools and students come together and create something so beautiful.
Yeah, that is amazing. It's just awesome the impact that art can have on the community.
Yeah, it really is. Like, I feel like most of the highlights that happened in 2023 were really very much community-based. And I think that's just an amazing thing to be able to accomplish. And that's our highlights, is they're all very much community art projects.
Headed into 2024, you mentioned it's your 30th anniversary coming up. That's so exciting. Do you have any plans for kicking off the year?
So we do have an artist exhibit coming up in the Window Art Gallery. It's Lisa Rich. She's got a month-long exhibit coming up, which is going to be super cool. She's a fiber artist and experiments in a bunch of different... she does 2D and 3D pieces. We're not doing anything as of right now for the 30-year anniversary. We're hoping to put up a reflection exhibit maybe in December at the end of the year. We're working on it.
In the works. Sounds good.
It's in the works, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, well, excited to see what comes out of your 30th year. Are you excited as executive director to be headed into your 30th year? That's awesome. It's an exciting year to join, I suppose.
I know, right? I am very excited. Maddie also, like my predecessor, had 2024 all lined up for the gallery. I'm really excited for a lot of the projects we have coming up and the artists that are coming in. We have so many different initiatives going on. We just got funding to do a beading circle for Indigenous youth, which we're partnered with Four Directions and the Kingston Native Center and Languages Nest, which I'm really excited about. But yeah, there's going to be so many things in 2024 coming up. I can't even list them all.
Super exciting. Yeah, and you're already getting out in the community and making a difference for 2024. How can folks keep up with and support the Kingston School of Art as we head into 2024?
Really, the way you can support us best is by keep registering for programs. We have memberships available now, and we're always working on making the memberships better and newer. Our membership program just got rolled out in the spring of 2023. So it's still a little bit of a work in progress, but we do have memberships available. We're always looking for volunteers to help out for programs or behind the scenes or with our different committees. And, you know, if you see that we're heading out for a community event, come by and say hi, and we can talk to you about all the different things that are going on at the Kingston School of Art.
Once again, that was Victoria Smythe, new executive director with the Kingston School of Art. For more information and to keep up with the school, you can head to ksoa.info. Naming rights
partner for the large entertainment venue on the Tragically Hip Way. The venue is currently known as the Leon Center and has been since 2018, but it may take on a new name beginning in January of 2024. The venue serves as the home for the Ontario Hockey League's Kingston Frontenacs, while also hosting many events and concerts. With a seating capacity of 5,000 for sporting events and 6,700 for concerts, it has been the site of many large-scale events. Bidding for naming rights took place over the summer, with applications being accepted until the end of August. Tonight, councillors will consider a 15-year agreement with Slush Puppy Canada Incorporated. The agreement would span 15 years, worth $135,000 per year, with a total of $2,025,000 over the period of the contract. Chief Administrative Officer for the City of Kingston, Lainey Hurdle, stated, quote, "The large venue entertainment center has a history of naming rights partners since its opening in 2008. We look forward to the continued animation of this incredible venue through the well-established, family-friendly Slush Puppy brand, and to working alongside the Slush Puppy team in partnership with the Kingston Frontenacs." If the terms of the agreement are accepted this evening, the arena will officially be dubbed Slush Puppy Place in 2024. This will be the second venue in Canada named after Slush Puppy, with the first being Slush Puppy Centre in Gatineau. Jean-Roch Baudin, president of Slush Puppy Canada, states, quote, "For nearly 50 years, Slush Puppy has been part of Canada's hockey heritage. This partnership highlights the long-standing love story between Slush Puppy and sports fans and participants from coast to coast to coast. It is an honor for Slush Puppy Canada to partner with the City of Kingston, a community rich in history. This second Slush Puppy venue will continue to serve as a hub for sporting events, concerts, and cultural experiences, contributing to the vibrancy of the Kingston community," end quote.
Thank you, Chris, for those stories. And now over to Jesse Bell, CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer, with a story by Local Journalism Initiative reporter Michelle Dory Forstall of thekingstonist.com about Napanee's Goodyear plant seeking the town's help for expansion.
Thank you, Dinah. A Tax Increment Equivalent Grant, or TIEG, was approved by the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee on Tuesday, December 19th. The TIEG was submitted by Goodyear Canada Incorporated and was applied for under Greater Napanee's Community Improvement Plan. Goodyear intends to expand its current factory in the region by an additional 420,000 square feet. According to a staff report that was presented to the council, the factory currently consists of an 830,000 square foot manufacturing, warehousing, and office facility that employs 800 full-time employees who are manufacturing and selling tires for light-duty vehicles. The expansion project seeks to increase annual production by 2 million more tires per year, create 200 highly skilled direct full-time jobs, and add an additional 400 indirect jobs. It also aims to increase purchasing from Canadian suppliers by 65%, going from $224 million to $346 million in 2030. Goodyear Canada Incorporated's projected budget is anticipated to exceed $550 million to support the expansion. The staff report presented to council stated that the construction valuation for this expansion project is $10 million. Additionally, the construction process would create 25 full-time permanent jobs in the Greater Napanee region. As stated in the report, the expansion project for Goodyear Canada will ensure that the factory in Napanee, quote, remains operational for decades to come. And now over to Dinah Jansen with a piece by YGK News Local Journalism Initiative reporter Owen Fullerton that discusses a strategy meant to support the City of Kingston's music community.
Thank you, Jesse. And other local news from Michelle Dory Forstall of thekingstonist.com. At the Tuesday, December 19th meeting of the Kingston City Council, the council considered a strategy meant to support the city's music community. The strategy calls for the transfer of $200,000 in funds from the capital budget of the Arts and Culture Services Department to Tourism Kingston to support the implementation of the strategy. The strategy also enlisted the consulting firm Nordicity to identify existing issues in the local music scene and make recommendations to support its growth and sustainability. The document is dense with a number of ideas that will be longer-term goals, but an immediate step and one that is emphasized in the strategy is the creation of a Kingston Music Office and the appointment of a music officer. That person will, in effect, act as the liaison between City Hall and the music community and try to lend a perspective from the music community to city-made decisions and events. Of the $200,000 proposed as an initial annual cost, $100,000 to $150,000 is expected to be used for staffing. To start, the establishment of a music office will be the biggest change to Kingston's music scene and will be integral to the pursuit of any recommendations laid out in the strategy. Kingston's acting director of arts and culture services, Danica Lockheed, says appointing a music officer is a recognition by the city that dedicated personnel are needed to move the strategy forward. They will have a lot of sway when it comes to music-related decisions, and Lockheed says their work will be critiqued by both the city and a community music working group to help oversee a successful implementation. Lockheed added that the main checkpoint and accountability place for the music officer will be both the city through regular reporting on work plans and key performance indicators that are identified and embedded within the Kingston Music Strategy. However, the biggest continual touchpoint for the music officer position will be through the Kingston Music Working Group, which will be comprised of community champions and working members in the Kingston music scene, including local musicians and union members. While the strategy ultimately looks to support the music industry with better economic conditions and other objectives like the creation of a mid-sized venue in Kingston, it's also meant to highlight how music can have residual benefits on the city, especially the tourism sector. While $200,000 is an initial ask to get the ball rolling with the establishment of a music office, $83,500 has already been spent on the consulting fee for Nordicity's work. And now back over to Jesse Bell with regional news from Keith Dempsey, local journalism initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, on the approval of a new fire hall in the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands.
Thank you, Dinah. The township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands Council has voted to hire JCB Construction to build the new fire station in Seelies Bay. The winning bid projected the total construction cost to be around $5.8 million. Council approved the motion 5-2 during a special meeting on Monday, December 18th. During the November 14th meeting, Council was made aware that a decision regarding the new fire station was needed by December 31st to avoid the tender lapsing. Any further deferrals by Council would have resulted in all current bids being rendered null and void. Councillor Angela Kelman was one of the five to vote in favor of contracting JCB Construction to build the new fire station. Kelman reasoned that the cost of building materials is likely as low as it's going to be, given inflation, and that the community could not wait another 2 years for a new fire hall. Councillor Jeff Lackey and Councillor Brock Gorell voted against the motion and proposed a redesign by Idea Incorporated. Gorell, in particular, took issue with the increasing costs of the project and the process as a whole. Gorell said that Council had been given an original quote in the ballpark of $4.2 million, but when the proposal came back from tender, it was, in Gorell's words, over $6 million. Gorell stated that, by this point in the process, Council had no opportunity to properly question the increase. Karina Smith-Gatke, mayor for Leeds and the Thousand Islands, defended her support of the proposal and noted that, according to the funding strategy, the money required to fund the project was, quote, a reasonable amount of debt for the municipality to take on. Back to Dinah Jansen with a story from local journalism initiative reporter Philip Blanchet for the Morrisburg Leader about charitable work in South Dundas that had a profound impact on those who needed it most this holiday season.
Thank you, Jesse. In our next segment, we have local journalism initiative reporter Philip Blanchard's recent report in the Morrisburg Leader on the recent work of the South Dundas Christmas Exchange. Thanks to an exceptional amount of community support and the work of a dedicated group of volunteers, nearly 500 people across South Dundas enjoyed a better Christmas, Blanchard reported. South Dundas Christmas Exchange chairperson Bonnie McNairn told the Morrisburg Leader that this year the community group supported 122 families, including 127 children and 42 individuals. In all, 478 people were helped by this group's initiatives. The donations and support from the community are absolutely fantastic, said McNairn. Volunteers were on hand on December 19th to pack boxes and prepare packages for delivery later in the week. The packages included a turkey or ham and a number of sides for a holiday meal. The organization works with the Morrisburg and District Lions Club Angel Tree Program and Iroquois-based volunteer Sandra Johnston to also deliver presents for children. There were more presents this year under the tree thanks to the Christmas Exchange supporters. There were also pajamas, books, and socks to go with the presents McNairn added. New to the program this year were seniors' gift packages for some of the recipients. These included some day-to-day items, which McNairn said are more expensive now with inflation. Individual and seniors' Christmas meals were provided by the exchange through its partnership with the Community Food Share. This year's numbers are slightly different from last year, but down from 2021. In 2022, the exchange provided 115 food baskets and helped 122 children. 2 years ago, over 500 individuals were part of the program. McNairn stressed that the exchange, while sorted in Morrisburg, supports families and across the municipality from Dixon's Corners to Riverside Heights and Iroquois to Elma. It's a South Dundas program supported by many across South Dundas, McNairn said, and that they couldn't do this without the generous support they receive. And now over to Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, with a story on the appointment of a new warden for the county of Lennox and Addington.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. At their final meeting of the year last Wednesday, December 13th, Lennox and Addington County Council welcomed their new warden and deputy warden.
The warden for the year 2024 is John Wise. The deputy warden for the year 2024 is Nathan Townend.
After the ballots were totaled, only the winners' names were announced and not the number of votes. Wise addressed council after becoming the new warden.
Well, thank you for placing your confidence in me, fellow councillors. And Terry, I'm sorry you didn't get in, but better luck next time. And thank you to Henry for his many years of service. I don't have a long speech here. For one thing, I'm nursing a respiratory infection and I don't want to go on. But I will just say a few words. Our county organization is large, and its responsibilities are varied. We operate a long-term care home, a paramedic service, social services and housing, libraries and a museum. We foster economic development and are involved in land use planning. We maintain and develop transportation infrastructure, information technology infrastructure, and manage a variety of properties. We have a budget of tens of millions of dollars, both from provincial funding and local taxation, and our financial staff are tasked with planning and reporting on a myriad of files. We employ hundreds of talented people with all the accompanying human resources services that come with such a large and varied cohort. We partner and work with many other public and private organizations. We maintain ongoing and routine operations and also deal with unique and unexpected issues at times. It's complicated, challenging, interesting, frustrating, and rewarding. Having said all that, our municipality is comparatively small. Our population is less than 50,000 people, and our budget is less than $100 million. A while ago, that sounded like a lot of money. These days, that's relatively small potatoes. A counselor's job is thus part-time. We're not on the job at county offices on a daily basis, and we gather as a body in meetings a few times a month at most, and sometimes only once a month. And sometimes, and though we get involved behind the scenes as individuals on particular matters from time to time, we rely on staff for the daily functioning of the corporation. As such, it is critical that our staff be of the highest possible caliber. We are fortunate to have just such a management team under the leadership of our talented, personable, and creative CAO. In my township, our CAO resigned earlier this year to seek other opportunities, and recently I sat down with our county CAO, Brenda Orchard, who had kindly offered to give me some suggestions about the qualifications a person should have to be an effective municipal CAO. As you can imagine, the list was long, but one thing Brenda said stood out for me. An essential quality of a person holding that position would be a sincere dedication to the idea of public service. Because that is our purpose as an organization, to serve the needs of our residents and our community. It's almost a cliche and should go without saying, but it bears repeating. It's the very first sentence in the guiding principles of our strategic plan, which states simply, we exist to serve our public. Let that continue to be the fundamental attitude that we bring to all our discussions, and through open-minded, frank, and well-informed deliberation, make decisions that truly fulfill that service ideal. I look forward to working with council and staff in the coming year, and I'm counting on your support. Thank you.
Council also appointed members to advisory and special committees, boards, and agencies for the new year. Councillor Hogg and Councillor Richardson were appointed to the Economic Development Coalition. Deputy Warden Townend was appointed to Kingston, Frontenac, and Lennox and Abington Public Health. Councillor Doug Davison and Councillor Brian Calver were appointed to the Prince Edward, Lennox and Abington Social Services Committee. Councillor Tony Fritch and Councillor Brian Calver were appointed to the Joint Accessibility Advisory Committee, and Councillor Jim Hagedorn was appointed to the Lafarge Community Liaison Committee. Council also appointed community members to the Joint Accessibility Advisory Committee and the Economic Development Coalition. For CJAI and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you, Ted. We will now move to a story about the installation of new CCTV cameras in Coburg by CFWN's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Jeff Gard.
Two new CCTV cameras have been installed by the Coburg Police Service in East End neighborhoods. The new cameras are at the intersection of Brook Road North and King Street East, and the other on Meredith Avenue. Coburg Police says its Organizational Development and Crime Analytics Department initiated the installation after reviewing feedback from the community canvas conducted in East End neighborhoods last month. Communications coordinator Lisa Monday said the CCTV program continues to expand.
It has been ongoing since 2020 when we received a grant through the Ontario CCTV grant program, and really working through our police tech accelerator to set up the mesh network. So it's been an ongoing project through our crime analyst department, and really taking a look at where the cameras should be best placed according to crime trends, community needs, community expectations. So the newest two cameras were installed in the East End as a result of the community canvas of hearing from many that they'd like CCTV within the neighborhoods. So those were the two newest cameras put through and worked into the existing network. So we're up to 28 operational cameras throughout the community. They're passively monitored, so they're not actively monitored, but for post-incident follow-up and investigations, and really allowing us to kind of take a look at what has happened and gain information so that we can put the best case toward court or respond to any other incidents, maybe missing person that's been seen in the area, and following up that way.
Monday said there are now 28 cameras installed around town, and that's expected to double by next summer. She reiterated that the cameras are not actively monitored.
So there's no one sitting there watching these cameras as they go on. It's when there's an event that or an incident that happens, then we can retroactively go in and take a look at that footage in hopes that we can, for investigative purposes, and to identify people and that kind of stuff. So it's all post-event. So people don't need to be worried that we're actively monitoring these cameras at any given time of the day.
Coburg Police have also just launched a voluntary community camera registry program for residents and businesses. The registry includes CCTV cameras and doorbell cams so Coburg police can learn where cameras may be located in the neighborhood and contact the owner to request footage if an incident occurs in that area. Monday said privacy is a top concern and the registry is another key resource for police.
This is another way that people can assist us in basically just knowing where cameras exist and then having that contact. That should an event or an incident happen in a certain area, we can look up, and whoever chooses to participate, we can look up and see if there's a camera in that area or that zone and contact the person and the owner of that camera and ask them for footage between a certain time that an incident has happened. So we don't have access to the cameras. We just are looking to identify where cameras do exist, that they can be an additional resource should something happen. So this will kind of expedite the time it takes to do a community canvas, to go door to door, to ask, hello, do you have a camera? Instead, we can quickly pull that up and see, oh, five people have cameras in the area. Now we can contact those five people with the contact information that they've given and ask them for footage around that certain time period of an incident. And really, it is at the hands of the participant to decide if they want to take that down at any time or add a camera, or if they move away, they can delete that. And then that's that. So it's pretty straightforward and very simple registry with minimal information. Only police have access. And it's really, we truly appreciate anyone that would be interested in participating in this registry.
To register, visit CoburgPoliceService.com. I'm Jeff Gard, reporting for Northumberland 89.7 FM.
Thank you, Jeff. And now over to the Local Journalism Initiative team at CJPE County FM in Picton with a story on the recent cancellation of a Prince Edward County meeting related to budget talks due to illness.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM News 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
In the wake of the Prince Edward County 2024 budget talks from 2 weeks ago, illnesses struck members of the council, resulting in the cancellation of the December 19th council meeting. The big issue hanging in the air is the awarding of the tender for the multi-million-dollar Wellington Trunk Line. Council pressed pause at the November 28th meeting after numerous individuals and grassroots groups pleaded with council to put the brakes on and investigate other options. The impact on taxpayers would be significant, and with current high interest rates, the fear is the developer may back out. A tender has been chosen and the issue will be the hot topic for the next meeting January 9th, as well as staff report on the Trey Resort application and the reconsideration of the U-Ride subsidy. At the meeting of November 28th, Council chose not to renew the U-Ride funding of $30,000, which is a living wage subsidy for the drivers. U-Ride started operations in the county July 2022 and has filled the gaps in the transportation needs in and around the area, especially during the height of tourism season in the summer. There are only two taxi companies operating in the county, and Rick Marshall, owner of the Taxi Guy, told Picton Gazette there is more business than they can handle during the summer and that they turn away about 50% of the calls. Council learned that U-Ride will pick up customers from the far reaches of the county day or night, where the taxi companies have a more limited range and hours of operation. The subsidy will be reintroduced by Councillor Hirsch at the January 9th meeting. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to the CJPE Local Journalism Initiative team. And now over to Jesse Bell with the CFRC Environment Canada Weather Report and Local Events Calendar.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, December 28th, unseasonably warm, 5-degree high, only dropping down to 2 degrees overnight. Friday, December 29th, that 5-degree mark will maintain, but an increased risk of showers both during the day and more consequentially overnight. Overnight, it will drop down to negative 4 degrees, 40% chance of rain showers or flurries. Saturday, December 30th, negative 3 as a high, cloudy during the day, negative 7 overnight, and then New Year's Eve, Sunday, December 31st, a high of negative 2, but an overnight low of negative 10, and Monday, January 1st, 2024, New Year's Day, a high of -4 with a mix of sun and cloud. And now on to the community and concert events calendar. On Thursday, December 28th, check out some Ontario Hockey League action as the Kingston Frontenacs host the Peterborough Petes at the Leon Center. Puck drop is scheduled for 7 p.m. On Friday, December 29th, check out Luella with Housewife and Almond Milk at the Broom Factory on 305 Rideau Street. The concert is scheduled to begin at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are available now online. There are three terrific concerts being held in the city of Kingston on New Year's Eve. Head over to the Tiernanog to check out the Trevor Walsh Band starting at 9 p.m. The Mansion will be hosting house music all night long starting at 10 p.m. And the Glorious Sons, the Glory Tour, they will be playing December 31st at the Leon Center. Tickets for that event are sold out. As we move into early 2024, be sure to check out the Kingston Frontenacs as they host the Ottawa 67s on New Year's Day. That's Monday, January 1st. Puck drop at 4 p.m. And the Frontenacs will be back in action on Friday, January 5th, hosting the Mississauga Steelheads. Puck drop for that game is scheduled for 7 p.m. This concludes the concert and events calendar for the week. This is Jesse Bell signing off and throwing it over to Dinah Jansen for a special message.
Thank you, Jesse, and thanks to our listeners for tuning into our program today. Please consider making a donation to CFRC to support our annual funding drive ending December 31st. And don't forget to follow CFRC's new Facebook and Instagram pages at CFRC Music. From all of us at CFRC 101.9 FM, have a safe and happy holiday, and best wishes to you and yours for a happy new year. Thank you for tuning into The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.